This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Power of Broke, how empty pockets, a tight budget, and a hunger for success can become your greatest competitive advantage. Written by Damon John with Daniel Paisner. Performed by Sway Calloway and Damon John.
What's up, everybody? It's the People Shark, Damon John. You know me from ABC Shark Tank. You also know me from being a founder and CEO of FUBU. And recently, thanks to you and my fans, a New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author. Now, you know, as someone who has dyslexia, I love listening to audiobooks. It's probably my favorite way to consume books. On the other hand, as someone who has dyslexia, recording an audiobook, that's going to take me 3 weeks, 500 edits, and I would never give the content the justice it deserves. But I could not let all my fans down. Ever since the book came out, I've had thousands of people on social media or even walking around in the streets asking me, when is the audiobook of The Power of Broke coming out? I clearly knew I had to do something. So in order to get this audiobook out to all of you and not have you suffer through me sounding like Elmer Fudd, I had to bring in a special person to read this book, someone I have a huge amount of respect for. His name is Sway Calloway. Sway is going to help me narrate majority of this book. You probably recognize him from MTV News and his incredible successful Sirius XM radio show Sway in the Morning. Now, I know many of you are going to want me to personally read this, but trust me on this. Sway comes from a very, very special place as an expert broadcaster, somebody who's lived the power of broke, somebody who is able to tell you my story in a way that you'll be able to visualize it. And don't worry, I'm going to be popping up throughout the book from here to there myself as well. With that being said, I want you to get ready. Here's my man, Sway Calloway. This book is dedicated to my friend David Freshman, a man who embodied the very best qualities of entrepreneurship and friendship. David always fought for what he believed in. David is a great father, a great husband, and a great contributor to his community. He never saw the color of a man's skin, but focused only on the integrity of a man's heart. Dave was one of the great early adopters, way before incubators and venture capitalists and angel investors saw value in this space. I can't thank David enough for always being there for me and actually investing in me, but with his faith, with his love, and his knowledge. The world was richer for him being here, and it's a poorer place without him. May he rest in peace.
1. The Power of Broke. The power of broke is a mindset. It exists in all of us, whether we have money, opportunities, or advantages. Trouble is, most people don't recognize this power for what it is. They leave it alone, or maybe they don't even know it's there. Instead, they buy into the line from people in suits, fancy offices, or business schools who tell us that there's a certain way to start businesses. We need money to jumpstart our business. But that only works for a few of us, and only for a while. Why? Because, take it from me, the power of broke is all about substance over flash. It's about creativity over certainty. It's about taking a shot over playing it safe. And here's another thing. The money runs out after a while. Those deep pockets you may or may not have, they'll never be deep enough to buy all the passion, ingenuity, and determination it takes to have success over the long haul. Even if you got money behind you, there's no guarantee that it will see you through. It's the money in front of you that counts, after all. It's the money you need, not the money you have, that makes all the difference. In this book, it's all about that difference and how to put it to work for you. Let's face it, when you're up against all odds, when you have exhausted every opportunity, when you're down to your last dime, that's when you've got no choice but to succeed. You're out of options, man. So double down, dig deep, and switch it to that relentless turbo mode we've all got kicking around in our machinery. And that's when the real magic happens. Are we clear on this? The power of broke is the half-court shot you fire up with the time running out and the game on the line. It's the shot your teammates won't take because the likelihood of that ball kissing the net, it's pretty damn thin, and they don't want to mess up with their stat lines. They're playing the percentages while you're playing to win. And this can mean everything. I don't mean to mix my sports metaphors here, but I'm reminded here of that great Wayne Gretzky line. We miss 100% of the shots we don't take. So, take the shot. Absolutely take the shot. The power of broke is all about taking that shot. The power of broke is looking up at the sky, wondering what you got to do to catch a break, and saying, God, why am I doing this? It's living with the constant fear that you've gone crazy for putting it all on the line, but putting it out there anyway. There might be a million reasons for you to throw up your hands, throw in a towel, throw away your dreams, and put an end to whatever craziness you're pursuing. But the power of broke is that one reason you keep going. Maybe you've been rejected by 30 loan officers, but that green light could be waiting for you on the 31st try. Perhaps your product or service has been totally slammed by the first 30 people who tried it, but the 31st review is a rave, and that comes from the one guy whose opinion really matters. Whatever it is, keep at it. Absolutely keep at it. Because, hey, you never know. When you've got nothing to lose, you've got everything to gain. Sometimes it takes having your back against the wall, leveraging your last dollar, and having no place to go but up, up, up if you expect something to happen. Because if you got to succeed to survive, you will. Trust me on this. Be a true innovator. Here's my take. Innovation happens from the bottom up, not the top down. Breakdancing, rap music, slam poetry, iPods, smartwatches, electric cars, all the most creative, the most successful, the most dynamic innovations pop in an organic way and then grow. Or not. You put your idea out there, no big thing, and it just kind of happens. Or not. People either respond to it or they don't. And it doesn't matter how much money you throw at it, how much you try to dress it up, it is what it is, and that's that. It has its own beating heart. You don't need me to tell you this. Just take a look at the world around you. Our favorite movies, the ones that win all the awards, the ones we talk about with our friends, tend to be the indie films that come from a small, sweet voice, a singular vision, and not the slick, big-budget, mainstream movies from the major studios. Yeah, those big blockbusters make the big bucks, and they can be a lot of fun, but they don't always light our imaginations or stir our souls, at least not in the same way. Just look what goes on at Art Basel in Miami Beach, the biggest gathering of international artists on the calendar. Hundreds and hundreds of the best artists in the world come to Florida every December to share their work, strut their stuff, do their thing. It's an amazing thing to see what some of these folks are up to. But it's not just the fine art displayed on the walls by the top galleries that makes all the noise. A lot of folks, they'll tell you, the real excitement of the show, the raw energy, is off to the side. That's where you'll find the street artists, the pop-up displays, the next big thing. And that's where you'll find the crowds. Because when it comes down to it, people want to experience something pure, something real. They want to be lifted from their everyday experiences, from what's expected, and set down in the middle of something completely and breathtakingly new. I come from the world of fashion. That's where I made my name. But at FUBU, we were never about high fashion. Our designs came from the streets, from our own hard-won style, our pride of place. The spirit of our clothes was in our name, for us, by us. And one of the reasons we captured a good chunk of the market was because we were authentic. We were true to ourselves. Were we completely and breathtakingly new? Not really. But what was exciting about our clothes, what a lot of folks connected to, was that we wore them proudly. They were a reflection of our world. FUBU isn't the only successful brand that launched in this way. A lot of the most iconic fashion brands started out in a small, hand-sewn way. Haute couture, at the high end of high fashion, is based on the same principle. High-quality clothing made by hand with a personal touch. In French, the word couture simply means dressmaking. And when it started out, it just referred to plain folks figuring out a way to dress nicely, to turn their rags and loose fabrics into clothing that made them feel a little more like nobles. But today, the term has come to symbolize the best of the best. Why? Because it came about in this genuine way. The same goes for architecture, literature, music, technology, design, fashion, every important innovation, every lasting impression, every meaningful trend, and every successful business comes from a singular vision, put out into the world with a small, sweet voice. It starts from the bottom and grows from there. Or not. Or not. Those two little words suggesting the possibility that things might not go my way. They're at the heart of everything I do. They're why I give myself the same marching orders every morning when I get out of bed. Rise and grind. Because in those three words, I find tremendous power. The power to do anything, to get past anything, to become anything. They remind me that the choice of whether to succeed or not is all mine.
All right, here's your power fact. 8 out of 10 new businesses fail within the first 18 months. It's not enough to have a good idea for a startup or a hot new product. Execution is key. And part of that execution comes in finding your voice as an entrepreneur. Why do so many new businesses fail? Many times, it's actually because they've been cashed to death. It's because businesses built on steroids and on injections of capital are living on borrowed time. When the money runs out, the business runs its course.
The idea that the best concepts and innovations tend to happen organically, authentically, is not limited to art and discovery. It cuts to our personal lives, too. Think about it. Our most lasting relationships are built on the same solid foundation. It's got to be pure, got to be real, or else it just won't work. If you're a guy and you pull up to meet a girl in a hot car, you'll make a certain kind of first impression, right? The two of you get together, you take her out for an expensive dinner, buy her a nice pair of shoes, and maybe some bling, you sip the finest champagne. By the end of the night, she's into you. And if you keep it up, at the end of the week, she's totally into you. Doesn't matter what you look like. Doesn't matter if you're a brilliant conversationalist or even if you share the same views. In some cases, you could be fat, bald, stupid, whatever. It only matters that you showered her with power, bought her a bunch of gifts and flowers, took her away on romantic weekends, and whatever the case may be, it all adds up. You presented yourself in a certain way, and if she responds to that certain way, that's great. I'm happy for you. Really. But what happens to that kind of relationship in the long run? What happens when all the money goes away and there's nothing left but to be yourself? What happens when you buy her a present every time you see her, and then all of a sudden you lose your job? Then what? Don't be surprised if you find your relationship was only as strong as the money you put into it. When the jewelry runs out, no more fancy dinners, and the getaway vacations end, what's left? You've been riding a superficial high, a false emotion, and it's bound to catch up to you. It will. Or maybe you're a woman looking to snag your dream man, so you slip yourself into a fine, beautiful dress, get yourself done with hair and makeup, work out like crazy so you can't help but turn all kinds of heads. You finally meet this amazing guy, and you really, really want him to pay attention to you, ask you out a second time and a third, and he does. And the two of you have a good thing going. For a while. Again, I'm happy for you. That's great. But then you get a little older. You gain a couple of pounds. The dress no longer fits. Or maybe you're living together, and you're stuck in the bed with the flu, looking all a mess in your footy pajamas. What happens then? Be genuine. Now, before you start beating up on me for presenting such superficial examples, let me just say that they're meant to be superficial examples. I'm trying to make my point in the extreme. No, women aren't just out for money and fine things, and men aren't just out for sass and sex appeal. The point is that if it's not authentic, if there's no there, Your relationship is not about to work in any kind of long-term way, no matter how you dress it up or how much money you throw at it. You might hang in for a while and have a nice little run, but it won't last. It can't last. It's the same in business. Let's say you open up a new restaurant. You design a gorgeous new space in the best part of town. You have no experience in the kitchen, but you have the money to hire a top chef, the best decorators. You have no vision, no specific market you're trying to serve, no style of cooking that speaks to you, but your research tells you that a certain kind of cuisine is crazy popular right now. The edge of the cutting edge. So that's what you decide to pursue. Basically, you focus group the crap out of the place, spend all kinds of money throwing in all the bells and whistles and every conceivable amenity, open your doors, and wait for the tables to fill. But it doesn't always work out that way, does it? Why is that, do you think? Well, let's say you're in the soda business, and you decide for some reason to shake things up, tweak your formula, try something new. You've already got the biggest, most successful brand in the world, and your market projections show steady growth for years and years. But you get it in your head that the soda drink in public is fickle, ready for a change. So you shave off a chunk of that money and hire a bunch of chemists to engineer a new flavor, a bunch of marketing experts to redesign your logo, a bunch of advertisers to help get the word out. You can afford to bring in the best of the best to work with you on this. Trouble is, you haven't taken the time to stir up any real interest in the marketplace. You haven't even identified any interest in what you're selling. There's been no demand for a new formula. Folks haven't really tried it or asked for it. And nobody's even saying they're tired of the old formula. You've gone down this road for no good reason, and you end up with New Coke, one of the biggest thuds in the history of product launches. Remember what happened there? Well, truth is, nobody outside the Coca-Cola company really knows what happened back in 1985 when New Coke hit the market, because nobody's talking. Nobody will cop to it. But I have some ideas. They teach case study classes on this New Coke fiasco at some of our top business schools, and I certainly don't have that kind of insight or expertise. And obviously, I can't put myself in the boardroom at Coca-Cola when these big-time executives made the series of decisions that set them down this path. But if I had to guess, I'd say that all their money got in the way, confused the issue. Probably, they were just making change for the sake of change, because they could afford to, and not because they needed to. Probably, there was a collective and colossal failure to acknowledge the simple fact that business is like any other innovation, any other relationship. It grows from the bottom up. Only here, it's not about a guy and a girl, an artist and her audience, a designer and his muse. No. Here, it's about your brand and your relationship with your customer, with the marketplace. It's a marriage. I'm giving to you, and you're giving to me. It's a partnership. I'm here for you, and you're here for me. If the authenticity is there, if the business is built on a solid foundation, you'll have a shot to succeed. If it's just a superficial enterprise built on flashy gimmicks, inflated hopes, and a big budget, the odds run a little longer. In today's digital age, even governments have got to keep it real. Just look at the so-called Facebook revolution that basically kick-started the overthrow of an oppressive regime in Egypt in 2011. The revolution in Tunisia that same year. Hong Kong's umbrella revolution of 2014, where protesters changed their profile pictures to images of yellow umbrellas to rail against election reforms, and on and on. These movements didn't succeed because they had big marketing budgets. They succeeded because they were real. It's gotten to where an entire nation can be energized by the force of a single idea put out into the world in a passionate way through social media, at little or no cost.
Power fact. According to WebDAM, a leading digital marketing platform, 25% of the world's total advertising budget is devoted to online promotions. Clearly, if you're out there to make some noise, if you want your message to pop, it's never been easier to reach your target audience with a direct hit. But You've got to keep it real if you want to make an impact.
Doesn't matter what you're selling. The power has shifted to the people. Doesn't matter if you're in government, in business, in a relationship. Today's buzzwords are transparency and authenticity. You got to keep it real, people. And you can't keep it real in business today if your strategy is to simply throw money at whatever roadblocks come your way. Because chances are, money alone won't get you past them. It's the force of that single idea, offered in a genuine way, that gets results, no matter how much money you put behind it. Stay hungry. My point here is that there's great value in being true to yourself, in that it helps to have your back against the wall when you're starting out. It helps to be up against it. It helps to have to scrape, hustle, dream your way to the top. It helps to have a passion for your pursuit, especially when passion is the only resource you can afford. It helps you to realize your dream because it forces you to keep that dream real. Bottom line, it helps to be so hungry you have no choice but to succeed. Better believe it, it helps. It does. Trust me, I know. Because that's where I was coming from when I started FUBU with three of my boys from my neighborhood in Hollis, Queens. I know, because now that I've turned my focus to helping others launch their businesses and grow their own brands, I see it all the time. Take it from me, the people's shark. That's how folks have come to know me on the ABC TV reality show Shark Tank, where I sit on a panel with four other investors listening to the pitches and proposals of our entrepreneur contestants. Anyway, that's how I come across, because that's who I am. Some of my colleagues on the show have developed reputations as ruthless dealmakers, and some as easy marks, easily won over by flash and publicity. Me, I have worked hard to champion the underdogs on the show, to shine a light on the hardworking success stories, and to help people recognize a good idea, a real idea, a winning idea. So here's the big idea at the heart of this book. When you start from a place of nothing much at all, when you're hungry and laser focused on succeeding at whatever it is you're out to do, when you're flat out determined to get where you're going no matter what, well, then you've got a running start. You're moving in the right direction for the right reasons. On the flip side of that, when you start with all kinds of resources, when funding isn't an issue, when failure isn't about to break you, well, then you're standing still. Absolutely, there's tremendous power in being broke. The more you need to succeed, the more likely it's that you will succeed. The more you've invested, and here I'm talking about emotional and personal investment, not a financial investment, the more you'll get back in return. And so I say it again, there's great power in having to scrape and scramble. The people I've met in business, the ones who've had their first breaks handed to them, they're missing a kind of fire inside, a hunger, a willingness to do whatever it takes to succeed. I'm generalizing, I know, and there are exceptions everywhere you look, but for the most part, it takes this certain fire, this certain hunger, to build any kind of real and lasting success. At least, that's how it was with me. And chances are, if you grab this book, that's how it is with you too. But here's the thing. The power of broke only works in your favor if you recognize it, tap into it, put it to work. Broke, on its own, is just broke. If you let broke beat you down, if you let it break you, you'll never find a way to thrive or even survive. You'll never lift yourself up and out and on to great things. But if you look broke in the face, if you define it, own it, make it a part of who you are and how you go about your business, well, then you've got something, people. Go back to the beginning. Remember those great Rocky movies? They came from a personal place, from the mind and heart of one artist. The first movie, anyway. After that, the small, sweet voice started to get drowned out by the Hollywood blockbuster machine. But that's a whole other point, so let's double back. When does Sylvester Stallone's Rocky character start to stumble? When he starts throwing all his money around, letting success go to his head, right? When he starts to surround himself with all these luxuries, starts to work out in a plush, cushy gym, sleeps in a nice, big bed, that's when he loses his edge. It's all right there in the song they used on the soundtrack, The Eye of the Tiger. When Rocky is coming up, running up and down those steps in Philadelphia, working out in those meat lockers, he has the eye of the tiger, man. He is determined, driven. He has the mentality that says, nobody's going to stop me from getting over this wall. Over, under, around, through. That wall means nothing to Rocky Balboa because he is focused. Because he has no choice but to fight his way past. Because he's been down so long, he can't breathe unless he finds a way to lift himself up and out. But then he isn't the underdog anymore. Then he's the champ, riding high, getting all kinds of endorsement deals, all kinds of distractions. And what happens? He starts to relax a little bit, takes his eyes off the prize, and he gets himself an ass whooping from Clubber Lang, Mr. T. It isn't until Rocky goes back to his old rival, Apollo Creed, and starts training again in the same rough and tumble, broke, desperate way he did before, that's how he's able to get back on his game. And it's not just about training in a dirty old gym. Apollo Creed tells Rocky he's got to buy into the whole power of broke mindset he had when he was facing his first title fight. He's got to move into a crappy room in the nastiest part of town. He's got to live in the hood. He's got to hustle. He's got to get down so low, there's no place for him to go but up. Basically, he's got to get his roots back into his DNA, shake the glitz and glamour from his thinking, and get back to work. Apollo puts it to him plain in one of the movie's key scenes. He tells Rocky why he lost that fight, what he has to do to win back the title. You lost your edge. You didn't look hungry. No, when we fought, you had the eye of the tiger, man, the edge. And now you got to get it back. And the way you get it back is to go back to the beginning. Rocky Balboa, at least Rocky III Balboa, gets away from wanting it, gets away from needing it. And it costs him. The same goes in business. When you want it, when you need it, you find a way to make good things happen. When you expect it, when you feel entitled to it, you might just be headed for an ass whooping. Now, I'm not suggesting that you can't start a business with a ton of money and great contacts behind you, because hey, too much of a good thing can still be a good thing. And I'm not suggesting that the only way to start a business is from a place of desperation, because hey, why struggle if you don't have to? But I am suggesting that there are all kinds of ways to turn every strike against you into an opportunity. I am suggesting that if you're dealt a lousy hand, you can find a way to play it in a winning way. And I am suggesting that being broke can actually be an advantage for you in business. Being broke forces you to be aggressive, creative, resourceful. All those good things. It forces you to be realistic about your pace of growth and keeps you from letting your hopes and dreams run away from you. It pushes you to think about what's in reach and reminds you to keep true to yourself. Sure, broke can have its downsides. You're behind on your rent. You don't have the cash flow to fill all those orders. Not exactly what you had in mind when you started out, is it? But keep your head up. Hang in there. Move ever forward. Trust me. If you do, all these drags on your bottom line can become empowering, liberating. They can become assets. The counterpunch to that great notorious B.I.G. song, More Money, More Problems. If you buy into that type of thinking, then it follows that the less you have, the more you stand to gain, right? Don't outrun your resources. Let's take a look at a Shark Tank pitch from the show's sixth season to help us frame the conversation we're about to have in the pages ahead. Sometimes it helps to see a living, breathing example of a theory so you can get your head around it. And I've got just a story to do the job for us. First, a quick word on the show. That's how a lot of folks know me these days, from my role as a panelist, /investor/entrepreneur on the hit ABC reality series. Shark Tank invites inventors and entrepreneurs into the studio to pitch business ideas and opportunities to a panel of hungry sharks who listen carefully to the pitches and then decide whether or not to invest their own money in a product or business. When we started back in 2009, our producer, Mark Burnett, tapped a bunch of sharks from all different backgrounds, all different industries. He then put a bunch of stars together and assembled his glitzy panel of famous entrepreneurs to help draw viewers. No, he put his own spin on the power of broke and cast a bunch of hungry, dynamic, aggressive personalities who basically lived the spirit of entrepreneurship that would drive the program. All of us were successful in our own ways, in our own worlds, but none of us were what you would consider a household name. The network actually fought Mark on this, but he dug in. He wanted to fill his panel with people who would keep it real, who wouldn't be afraid to sweat to make these businesses work. The concept was that each shark would have a certain area of expertise, and together we'd be in a good position to respond to any pitch on a business or product. I was the fashion guru with a good gut for trends in pop culture and lifestyle. But over the years, all of the sharks on the show have developed a knack for spotting opportunities across a broad spectrum. We might have started out as experts in real estate, fashion, direct marketing, technology, whatever, but by now, we've become generalists. We've got our teeth into everything. Now, you have to realize that the Shark Tank pitches that get edited down to 10 or 12 minute segments on the show can run an hour or 2 hours or even longer in the studio. A lot of times, we'll tape a segment that never makes it onto the show, and we never really know what pitches will be featured on an upcoming episode until the week it's on. I try to catch the show every time we air a first-run episode, but because my travel schedule is so crazy, I'm not always able to watch it. So there I was, watching a pitch we heard a couple of months earlier, a story I pretty much forgotten about after the taping. Here's how it went down. We were visited in the tank by two young guys, Joel Vinneker and Arsene Egge, who'd developed a line of running, walking, and workout shoes called For Us. Pay close attention to the name For Us because it factors in. They were seeking a $200,000 investment in exchange for a 15% stake in their company. Like a lot of our contestants, they had all these gimmicks attached to their pitch. They sprinted onto the set to really sell the point that they were marketing athletic shoes. Cute, right? They brought a pair of shoes for each of us on the panel, which they'd sized ahead of time and encouraged us to put on. A personal touch, don't you think? And they set up an impressive display of their various shoe lines in a bunch of different colors and styles. How's that for an eye-catching reminder of the potential reach of the brand? What struck me about these guys, though, wasn't their stunts. It was their enthusiasm for their product. It was in the way they carried themselves, in the way they presented their shoes, in the way they spoke of their mission. But then, as I listened to their pitch, I was struck by the name of their company, For Us Athletics. It reminded me, of course, of FUBU, an acronym that stood for us, by us, and was meant back in the day to reinforce for our customers that we were just like them, making clothes we wore ourselves. At the time, my partners and I thought it was the kind of name that could start a movement, away from the big department store brands that seemed to cater to rich white kids, and toward a self-styled clothing line that was inclusive, affordable, and shot through with street cred. And it did. Folks came to know us on the back of our name, to connect with us. It got to where people could tell the story behind our name, even if they never tried on any of our clothes.
Power fact. Small business optimism is higher than it's been at any time since even the Great Recession. Now, that's according to Capital One Small Business Confidence Score. We see evidence of this stat all around us, but optimism is only going to take you so far. Small business owners know better than anyone how important it is to stick to a core business plan, to make great strides with small steps, and they know that imagination and patience will see them through.
Right away, I felt a certain kinship with these Forrest guys, because I had to think they were looking to make the same kind of personal connection with their target market. They were athletes themselves, and they designed a shoe that was lighter and more flexible than other shoes on the market, with greater shock absorption and a memory foam core that helped to form a custom fit over time. Plus, their shoes were affordably priced, retailing from between $75 and $85. There was every good reason to think these guys would be a runaway success. But for some reason, they were here on the show, looking for money. So what we wanted from them wasn't their profit projections or branding strategies. We wanted to hear their story. Know your market, know your mission. One of these guys, Arsene, talked a little bit about his background, growing up in Côte d'Ivoire on the coast of West Africa. He told us he had to flee the country after the civil war there. He spoke about how his father had died in his arms. He said he literally had to run to this country, earning a track and field scholarship to a school in the United States, eventually making it to law school. What this young man had to endure in order to get an education, stand on his own two feet, and to get to a place in his life and in his business where he could go on national television and make a passionate appeal for what he and his partner believed was much needed funding, well, it was the power of broke on full display. And yet my fellow panelists weren't buying it. Each shark had a good reason for passing on the pitch. Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, already had a shoe endorsement deal for his basketball team, so he was out. Lori Grenier, the queen of QVC, worried that Forrest wouldn't be able to knock the big boys like Nike, Saucony, and Adidas off the shelves, so she was out too. Kevin O'Leary, our serial entrepreneur, praised the team for growing their business to this point, but said he thought there were too many challenges ahead of them to justify the valuation they were seeking. Also out. That left me and Robert Herjavec, our tech guy, turned Dancing with the Stars hoofer. And frankly, I was concerned that these entrepreneurs were looking to do too much. They were caught between wanting to be a performance brand and a fashion brand. And they had a licensing deal with NASCAR that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. They had so many lines and styles that they were looking at an inventory nightmare because they had to stock and ship shoes in all different sizes and half sizes, so I was out. Robert, meanwhile, seemed to like the business. He loved that these two guys were go-getters, hard chargers. He loved that they scraped and clawed their way to this point. And he thought they were onto something with these lightweight performance shoes. But Robert had no experience in this end of retail, specifically in managing such a complicated inventory setup. So what did he do? He tried to bring me, the fashion guy, back into the deal. He said he would invest if I'd join him as a partner. I hated that Robert put this back on me, set it up so I could make or break a deal when I'd already passed on it. But hey, I took his point. Retail was an area of strength for me, especially when it involved so many styles and sizes. Robert's strengths were in finance, technology, and he saw that there was an opportunity here that had yet to be realized. He wasn't out to throw me under the bus so much as to invite me to hop back on and join him for the ride. So I thought about it some more. It was tempting, because I really liked Joel and Arsene, liked what they'd accomplished, I wanted to see them succeed. But I didn't see how a deal could work. So I went back to Arsene, who seemed to run the pitch, but I couldn't get him to rethink his approach. And as I worked it over in my head, I realized that this was a textbook example of the power of broke idea at the heart of this book. From what I could tell, outside looking in, Forrest had once been a bare-bones operation. These guys had started with an idea, a passion for running, and a firm belief that they could build a better running shoe. As far as we could tell on the panel, they had done just that, and they were successful in a limited way. As a result, they'd reached a point where they were having trouble filling their orders. But instead of digging in and focusing on this one piece that was probably within their control, they set their sights too high and started in on all these different line extensions, setting it up so that they could count on having even more trouble filling those orders and managing their inventory going forward. In the end, I passed on a Forrest investment a second time, and we sent these guys away empty-handed. All of us were rooting for them to succeed, but none of us were willing to back that success with our own money. I caught a lot of social media heat for turning these guys away, in the way it worked out, for keeping Robert from doing a deal he was only interested in making if I was involved. The feedback that came in on this pitch seemed to single me out, almost like folks were expecting me to do the deal. It's like I'd cast the deciding vote, and now I was the bad guy, even though that's not exactly how it went down. Still, I couldn't see how money was the answer to the growing pains this company was facing. Already, Forrest had taken in over $500,000 in sales over this previous 6 months, and at that level, the business would pull Joel and Arsene in the direction they needed to go. It would happen organically, or not at all, but it wasn't something money could buy. Sometimes you need an infusion of cash to grow your business to the next level, but this didn't feel like one of those times. No, this felt to me like these entrepreneurs had reached a tipping point. They could lean one way, branch out in all these different directions, and continue to struggle. Or they could lean back the way they started out, get a handle on their inventory, scale back on a number of product lines and extensions, and grow in a more organic way. I hated to turn these guys down, but I believe I did them a favor. Was I out to do them a solid by refusing to invest with them? No. I was looking out for myself. Let's face it, I'm in the business of making money, not subsidizing people just because I like them or I like their story. The solid came as a kind of byproduct, because I honestly believed that they were better off without the $200,000 they were seeking. It didn't matter if that money came from me, or Robert, or Mark, or Lori, or Kevin, or if they went out and found a way to raise some money away from the show. It only mattered that it would have tempted Joel and Arsene to continue veering off in the wrong direction. More money would have just confused the issue, left these Forrest guys thinking they could do anything, pushed them more and more from their core concept, encouraged them to spend more time on their software or their ill-conceived NASCAR line, instead of taking the time to engage authentically with their customers and learn what they really wanted. Point is, sometimes money isn't the answer. That's the power of broke, baby. It can make you or it can break you, and it's on you which way it will go. Sharpen your shark points. On Shark Tank, if someone comes in with the product and tells the panel he has $50 worth of sales, he gets laughed off the set. We fall out of our seats. But if that same someone then tells us his product only cost a dollar and that $50 in sales came in under 3 minutes, selling from the trunk of his car in the parking lot of a local mall, well, then it's a whole other equation. Then everyone on the panel goes quiet, wondering which of their fellow sharks will start bidding. And next thing you know, there's a feeding frenzy. Why? Because without even realizing it, this wannabe entrepreneur has stumbled onto a proof of concept that opens doors and generates business. He's sold his first widgets or gadgets or whatever and taken the pulse of his market in a meaningful way. Put another way, he's maximized the power of broke and put it to work for him. That's just what happened for me and my partners when we launched FUBU in the early 1990s. But the world has changed. The strategies that worked back then won't necessarily work today. But there are whole new strategies that have now come into play. At the same time, just as the world has changed, the key elements to any startup remain the same, in an eat or be eaten, kill or be killed kind of way. Understand, the principles behind those strategies are still very much in play, and I return to them constantly when I speak to business and student groups. Lately, I've bundled these principles into an easy-to-remember acronym, which I call Shark Points. The idea is to get audiences to start thinking like a shark, the same way we do on the show as panelist investors. It's the perfect metaphor for the power of broke, when you think about it. What do we know about sharks? They're ruthless, right? They're hungry. They feed on the weakness of lesser creatures. They're smart and swift and used to getting their way. All in all, the same characteristics that can help you out in a business setting. Which, of course, was why the producers of the show hit on that whole Shark Tank theme in the first place. But what else do we know about sharks? They're majestic creatures, right? They're powerful, resourceful, aggressive, hungry. All the qualities you need to take a bite out of your business. Plus, a shark has all these pilot fish swimming around him that helps him to feed. But at the same time, they help to feed the shark, meaning there's a symbiotic relationship in place. As big and majestic and powerful as he is, a shark can't go it alone. A shark also smells opportunity from a great distance, like a drop of blood in the water 5 miles away. A shark does not spend his energy on small things because it has to reserve its energy. And a shark travels the entire world. It's very hard to hold a shark back as he sets off and does his thing. So, what are my shark point basics?
Set a goal. The first point is about as basic as it gets. What it comes down to is knowing where you're headed. Be realistic on this, though. Aim too high, and you're about to be frustrated and disappointed. Aim too low, and you might actually leave some opportunities on the table. So take the time to get it right. Think what's possible in a best-case scenario. Think what's possible in a worst-case scenario. Think what's in reach, then reach just a little more. But write it all down on paper, and I want you to commit to it. Homework. Do yours. In almost every business, analytics are key. Know your field, know your competition, and know your stuff. After all, if you don't know your stuff, how can you hope to know what's possible? How can you prepare yourself for what's coming? Think of it this way. Out in the ocean, a shark doesn't attack unless it knows its prey. Here on land, a shark needs the same mix of insight, instincts, and information to keep out in front. And a shark needs to know that there's nothing new under the sun. I want you to face up to this fact, people. I hate to be the one who tells you this, but let me give it to you straight. You will never create anything new again. Twitter, that was just an updated version of tying a note to a pigeon's leg. Facebook, nothing more than an endless chain letter. Or another way to look at it, scribbles on a bathroom wall. Oh yeah, Instagram, right? That's a scrapbook you used to keep and share with all your friends. All there is, are, and all there ever will be is a new form of delivery, a new way to market it, and a new way to figure it out. Now on Shark Tank, we see it all the time. Someone on the show says, I have the newest thing. No, you don't. You really don't. What you have is maybe a new way or a new approach to market it, a new audience. So part of doing your homework means appreciating the history of the idea, the history of the market, and appreciating your competition. A fool can learn from his own mistakes, but a wise man learns from the mistakes of others. That's a line I picked up from Mr. Magic, old school radio DJ in New York. I really loved him. Anyway, let me get back to the point. The thought behind this reinforces the concept that there are no new ideas, only new ways to execute those ideas. Adore what you do. Now, it just comes down to passion. You've got to love, love, love what you're doing. Otherwise, why not just do something else? That was my deal starting out. I love clothes. Love seeing people in my designs. Love dreaming up new concepts. And that's the deal for every one of the successful entrepreneurs, influencers, and innovators you're about to meet in this book. They love what they do. The only way to do great work is to do what you love. Now that one's from Steve Jobs, and it's been repeated into the ground, but I'm repeating it here because it's an all-important point. Own it, love it, live it, and then I'm sure you're going to find a way to make it work. Remember, you are the brand. Now, I wrote a whole book on this called The Brand Within. And here's how I opened it. You are what you eat. You are what you wear. You are what you drive, where you live, what you drink, how you vote, what you stand for, how you love, hate, dedicate. You with me on this? I still feel the same exact way, especially when it comes to building a business or career. It all starts with how you carry yourself, what you put out in the world, the way you interact with your audience, your customers, your marketplace. It is really on you, and it is on just you. Keep swimming. Even when they're asleep, sharks are slipping through the ocean, swimming, scheming, getting ready to attack, which is pretty much the approach you have to take when you're starting out in business. You have to be relentless, nimble, moving ever forward, no matter what. And real sharks out in the ocean, if they stop swimming, they die. I want you to keep that in mind, too.
To understand these shark points more fully, check out the guide I've created specifically for you at DamonJohn.com/powerofbroke. It's a dynamic resource designed to help you wrap your head around this shark mindset and to guide you as you begin to tap into assets you might not even know you have. Don't just take my word for it. So here's what's about to happen in the pages ahead. I'm going to introduce you to a dozen or so successful individuals from all different backgrounds, with different skill sets, different visions, different approaches, different lines of business. And let's be clear, these people aren't just successful, they are wildly successful, at the top of the top of whatever it is they do, wherever they find their passion, their purpose. You'll meet Gigi Butler, a cleaning lady from Nashville who found a way to build a cupcake empire on the back of some simple family recipes and a sound, simple strategy. Rob Derdick, the fearless and peerless professional skateboarder who turned his passion for extreme sports into a global franchise. Kevin Plank, the founder and CEO of the ridiculously successful Under Armour sports apparel line. Acacia Brinley, a pioneering influencer on social media who learned as a teenager to leverage her personal brand into a personal fortune. Christopher Gray, the high school student from Birmingham, Alabama, who found a better way for students and families to access millions of dollars in unused scholarship funds, and on and on.
Power fact. The initial $10,000 raised by my fellow shark, Nick Woodman, to fund his GoPro launch came from selling bead and shell belts out of his Volkswagen van. Ah, what a great example of doing whatever you have to do to get it done.
The common thread knitting all these uncommonly successful individuals together is that they've come at their achievements from essentially the same place. The paths they had to take and the business and opportunities they're pursuing are all wildly different, but there are common themes running through their stories. They share a lot of the same traits. They are all hungry and determined. They all practice the power of broke, except in different ways. They've all had to scramble with little or no money to get where they are today, at the very top of their fields. In some cases, they might have grown up with a certain level of privilege. You know, maybe there was family money or professional contacts that could have certainly offered a leg up, but that edge never really came into play, and all of them would probably tell you they wouldn't have had it any other way. Meaning, if they had to do it all over again and relaunch their business or product with unlimited resources, they'd still reach for the up against it, seat of the pants approach. That's the power of broke. My idea here is to show rather than tell. I could pound my chest all I want and tell you there are all kinds of smart, creative, desperate ways for you to make the best of a bad situation and get your business going without a whole lot of cash. But end of the day, that's just me pounding my chest. That's just me telling my FUBU story. A story I take out on the road with me when I talk to business and student groups, more and more these days ever since Shark Tank premiered in August 2009. When the show started out, the world knew me as just a hip-hop fashion mogul. I had my hand in a bunch of different businesses, fragrances, music, movies, spirits, jewelry, and accessories. But folks mostly knew me as the FUBU guy, until Shark Tank. By the end of that first season, I was getting tons of invitations to appear before this or that group of entrepreneurs and tons of interview requests to share my thoughts on what it takes to start and sustain a business from a place of nothing much at all. Out of those conversations, I've learned that we lift each other up by sharing our stories. But like I said, you don't need to hear it only from me. Better to shine a light on the innovators you're about to meet. Creative, hard-charging, resourceful visionaries who found a way to make something out of nothing. Check out their stories, and you just might be inspired to find a way to put the power of broke to work for you. 2. Rise and grind. There are those three words again, right at the top of this chapter. My reminder to myself and to the hundreds of thousands of people who follow me on social media to get up and get to it. So let's get to it here. And to start, let's take a look back at some of the formative influences of my childhood and how they formed this mantra that still guides me today. I didn't have much growing up. I lived with my mother in Hollis, Queens, just the two of us. She worked constantly, two or three jobs most of the time, home late, up early, constantly moving, doing. She was disciplined, diligent, determined to set me up so I could have some kind of shot. The thing is, in my neighborhood, some kind of shot had lots of double meanings. Sad to say, most of them with emphasis on the word shot. Can't lie, won't lie, the crowd I grew up with was getting into all kinds of trouble. Trouble with guns, drugs, school, stolen cars, you name it. Some serious stuff. And me, I got into my share right alongside. Wasn't so deep into it as some of my boys, mostly because my mother was on me to keep my head down and steer clear. But it was there, close enough to taste, touch. There were bad decisions all around. Mine to make if I leaned the wrong way, mine to avoid if I could make the right call. My mother was a smart lady, real smart. She knew the deal. She knew I was a mostly good kid with a mostly good head on my shoulders, but she also knew what it meant to run in this kind of traffic, especially growing up with a mom who wasn't around. So when I started high school, she took out a mortgage on our house for $80,000. Funny how I remember the details. It was a lifetime ago, but it's like it was yesterday too. That might seem like a lot of money, but when you break it down, it didn't go very far. Because my mother's plan was to use the loan to replace the money she'd been earning on all those jobs. We had to live off that for the next 3 years until I finished high school. We had to pay all our bills off of that, service the debt on the house off of that. So no, it didn't go very far at all. And look at it another way. Her other option would have been to keep working all those jobs and to send me off to boarding school, military school, someplace where I would have been watched over constantly. But we couldn't afford that, no way, no how. Even if she dug deep, took out loans, tapped into some scholarship or grant monies, it wouldn't have worked. It might have been what I needed, but it would have been out of reach. Anyway, $80,000, just enough, my mother thought, to let her dial things down at work and spend some more time at home with me, peeping and sweating my every move, helping me to skate past all those negative influences in our neighborhood. Guess she figured if she didn't make sure I had at least a toe on the straight and narrow, I might set off on the completely wrong path. One way to look at it, that $80,000 was like my mother's investment in me. Another way to look at it, mothers are the ultimate startups, our true angel investors.
Power fact. Steve Jobs sold his car, and Steve Wozniak sold his calculator so they could scrape up enough money to build a prototype of a computer circuit board that would become known as the Apple One. Sometimes, you just have to find the equity you need in the stuff you already have.
Couldn't have been an easy decision for my mother to shut off that income stream the way she did, especially knowing it'd be tough to get back the good jobs she was leaving. But she didn't think she had a choice. This is what she felt she had to do to keep me on track. This is what it cost to keep me safe and focused. I don't think I appreciated her sacrifice at the time. Didn't even recognize it for what it was. It's like she did a complete 180, changed her entire MO just to give me a shot. In her bones, she knew I needed a kind of compass to make sure I was headed in the right direction. And she knew, as compasses go, she was the closest I'd ever get to true north. Looking back, I see what my mother saw, feel what she felt. You have to realize, when I was little, I mostly made little kid type trouble. When I got bigger, the trouble got bigger too, and the consequences even bigger. Like I said, my friends were into all kinds of crazy stuff. Wasn't long before this one was getting shot, this one was getting arrested, this one was getting murdered on the back of a drug deal gone bad. Every month or so, there'd be some new tragedy, some epic human fail that could have been avoided. So she just figured, hey, let me stop working a little bit and get in Damon's face a little bit, and I'll be there to pick him up if he stumbles, you know. Whatever happens, whatever he's into, he'll have somewhere to turn. And that's how it went down. My mother ran the numbers in her head and figured $80,000 she took out.